Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast with Trent and Leighton Kling. Coming up on today's show, we'll talk office supply retail as Office Depot and Office Max released their earnings call. We'll also talk about a regional grocer up north that's been exploring a potential sale for a while, and we get some clarity from their CEO on that process. We'll start out talking about off-price retail. A reminder to like us and rate us wherever you do listen to us, and you can check us out on Twitter and Instagram at Retail Podcast. So we begin with an under-the-radar earnings release in this larger earnings season, and that is from Off-Price Reclamation Project Tuesday morning. The reason we call them a reclamation project, well, Tuesday morning's last few years have been a roller coaster, mostly down, but a little up there. And in fact, the roller coaster could be even a little bit of an understatement between losing executives, some false starts on their turnaround plans, and some positive earnings surprises mixed in. Tuesday morning has been all over the map, and at times it's looked like Tuesday morning would remain stuck in the mud, but recently there's been some reason to believe in some momentum as they undergo rebranding and a larger store refresh and relocation program. So they're relocating a lot of the stores throughout their chain. But here on this earnings call, we got some interesting news because, again, it's like one step forward and one step back for Tuesday morning. They're looking at maybe potentially going a different path in terms of how they work inventory into their business, and that may cause some hiccups long term. But even still, their earnings for this year's third quarter were expected to be worse than the same quarter last year, with analysts' estimates expecting a loss of 25 cents per share this year versus last year's adjusted loss of 18 cents per share. And actually, in terms of their bottom line, Leighton, their earnings call wasn't that bad and beat estimates.
This is one of those situations where the company beat on earnings, but there was enough negative in their earnings release from macro factors like trade worries that the stock cratered a little bit on Tuesday after the release. And if you look, yes, the earnings call did take place on Tuesday morning. They tend to do that, May 7th to be exact. The stock was down around 30 cents in early Tuesday trading, or over around 14%. So when we say cratered, we're not really diving into hyperbole here. And their adjusted net loss, to Trent's point, on a per share basis came in even with last year's 18 cents per share figure. This was despite top line revenue falling from $223 million last year to $211 million this year. And this is a company, Trent, that really, again, to your point, has seen ups and downs throughout the course of their almost five decade old history. And so the company has now found a way to be a little bit more profitable. So that's good, at least, right on track for their previous goals. And really, it's to lose less money on less revenue, which is largely what they've set out to do during this latest reinvention. However, the negatives do lie in the reduced revenue, which was impacted by two things. First, they've closed a net amount of 14 stores so far this fiscal year. So that, of course, is going to have a negative impact on those top line figures. But worse, or far worse for the chain, is their comparable store sales decreased 5.3% versus last year's third quarter. We use the term comparable instead of same because the company has seen a handful of relocations that we've talked about here recently and renovations in the past year. Tuesday morning, leadership had a slew of excuses on the decline, which was a factor of around a 2.6% decline in the number of transactions and 2.8% decline in average ticket. That's a double negative there. Figures we do not like to see on this podcast when discussing earnings calls. Among the excuses was the Easter shift, which we've seen from other retail companies, which would legitimately impact Tuesday morning and their business model. However, they aren't expecting a large positive impact from Easter in the fourth quarter. More on this in just a little bit. Steve Becker, their CEO, said a late start to spring weather in most of the country was also partially to blame for the retailer. They also blamed a change in promotional activity, going from three promotional events in the quarter a year ago to now just one this year. And this has been a strategy over the last couple of quarters that they've talked about. They really want to engage their customers on a different level and sort of elevate their brand. The change in promotional activity comes as a result of their most recent re-imaging, as Tuesday morning's leadership felt like it was the constant promotional activity was really helping to erode those margins, while not especially being germane to their customer base, and it appears as though at least some customers care about the promotional activity, declines enough to stay away from even going in the retailer, hence those traffic declines. Finally, they blamed, in part, failure to capitalize on some trends they were seeing from a merchandising standpoint.
So with all of these things that Layton's talking about negatively impacting sales, why were the margins better for Tuesday morning? Well, on the margin front, they credited improvements in initial merchandise markup, and that's a quote from the earnings call. Basically, they mean charging more for their products right out of the gate. So they're trying to find an optimal price point, one that's not too low and one that gets them a decent margin up front. And this has some crossover with their goal of decreasing promotional activity, but mainly they're concerned with hitting ideal price points when merchandise hits the floor. There had been some earlier concern about certain price points on popular merchandise categories being too low. So you were seeing merchandise fly out the door, but it was at the cost of margins. And so this is an endeavor here to optimize price points to increase that markup from the get-go. Additionally, they credited lower supply chain costs. Supply chain is something they've harped on for several years now. We'll talk about it a little more in just a moment. There was some offset to these better margins due to inventory shrink, but mainly that offset was due to freight costs. As Layton mentioned in a recent episode, we should expect to see a lot of coverage of transportation costs going up during this earnings season as the price of fuel is up significantly over 1 year ago, but also the price to pay freight carriers has gone up, wages for truck drivers going up. So you're seeing kind of a domino effect or a ripple effect throughout, and I would expect to see transportation costs increasing for a number of retailers during this earnings season. So let's talk about their outlook as well on the call. And this was a main reason why their stock dipped after the earnings call on Tuesday. Layton mentioned there were some macro factors at play. The market didn't really have a great week this last week. But mainly, the stock price falling had to do, at least it seems like, with the forward outlook issued by Tuesday morning during the earnings call. And although they beat guidance, they decreased expectations for the fourth quarter and their full year results, something many analysts didn't like. And they're now expecting their fourth quarter comps to come in flat to slightly negative. And additionally, they expect comps for the fiscal year to be flat, currently sitting at a positive 0.3% through three quarters, mostly buoyed by the first two quarters of the year, because again, this third quarter really struggling in terms of comp sales. And you might say, well, wait, didn't we just talk about the movement of Easter out of the third quarter hurting their comps in this last quarter? And the fact that Easter is moving into the fourth, might that help out their fourth quarter comps? Well, that appears to not be the case when they released guidance. And they mentioned they weren't going to discuss April explicitly on the earnings call, but that any effect from Easter was baked into their guidance. So this basically means one of two things. One, either their Easter sales weren't great, which they would certainly have a decent handle on at this point since it's been a few weeks since those Easter sales took place, or their Easter sales were good, but not enough to overcome the erosion of traffic from their decreased promotional activity. And of course, it could be some combination of these two things. Maybe Easter sales were tepid and they're seeing decreased traffic there. But again, Becker, when asked, flat out refused to address April sales on the call when he was asked in the analyst Q&A. And ultimately, you know, looking at things here, you want retail businesses to be profitable. At the end of the day, that's what you're aiming for. And it seems like Tuesday morning is making strides to this end, but we also know that people love promotional activity. And the slowdown of it at Tuesday morning is unquestionably hurting traffic. When you look at two recent examples, go back to JCPenney and Victoria's Secret over the last 10 years, we can see that sometimes prioritizing margin at the expense of traffic can have negative effects. And you can argue that JCPenney really never recovered after former CEO Ron Johnson elected to have a more static pricing structure without constant promotional activity, kind of advertising the low prices every day model without the prices actually necessarily being lower than that promotional activity. Likewise, Victoria's Secret was hammered after they cut back on promotional activity a few years ago. And honestly, it's a good thing that they had Bath & Body Works in the company L Brands, because they helped to hold Victoria's Secret up as they're still trying to dig out of that hole that came about from a lack of promotional activity, a lack of coupons in particular being sent out. And with the tepid comps expected for the fourth quarter at Tuesday morning, you really worry if the faltering traffic might have some longer-term effects and if we might be talking about 3 to 4 years from now, Tuesday morning, still trying to dig out of this hole of that reduced promotional activity.
Perhaps worse than the sales projections, there is some worry that the company may have to make some revisions to their supply chain initiatives. As we mentioned earlier, they've been discussing optimizing their supply chain for some time now and have really only begun to realize some benefits from all of their previous initiatives. So what is the problem exactly with their supply chain, you may ask? After all, they've said it has now normalized. The problem really isn't with their supply chain, but rather with potential new initiatives coming after a consultant came in to evaluate Tuesday morning's model. This consultant, Becker said, is a, and I quote, veteran off-pricer. The consultant ended up recommending keeping more inventory on hand and in warehouses by way of flow and hold and pack and hold, at least more so than the company is currently doing. This is causing Tuesday morning to reevaluate their capacity within their supply chain to ensure that they can follow through on this suggested initiative. And so you look now, Trent, one thing to note, Tuesday morning isn't really sold on holding a greater amount of inventory at any one given time, but they're looking into options should they decide to go in that direction as a business strategy. The strategy, by the way, has served the likes of Ross and Ollie's Bargain Outlet extremely well in the most recent years. Analyst Jeff Van Sinderen asked some really great questions on the call that we listened to, both about their less than stellar comp expectations and the reanalysis of their supply chain problems. And Becker broke down their supply chain options into four groups after being questioned about it. The first option is basically doing nothing, simply continuing to exist with the supply chain as currently constructed. The second is to retrofit their current existing facilities, which already went through a little bit of a recent facelift, by the way. They had to put out some CapEx for those initiatives. The third option is to potentially move a facility to a larger one within the same market. The fourth is to open a new facility, potentially not within their existing facility footprint. Now, with all of those concerns about potentially forging out on a bit of a different path organizationally, their projected net loss for the fiscal year 2019 is projected now to be between $13 and $15 million, much improved from a net loss of $21.9 million in 2018. Such a loss looks even better when you compare it to 2017, where the company showed a net loss of a whopping $32.5 million. So the company is cutting back on yearly losses, which if you're a shareholder, like Trent has been in the past, I believe, then this is a good thing. And their debt position hasn't really been getting a lot worse. Their margins are looking better. However, you must ask, at what cost? Is this a short-term margin boost at the expense of future customers, like we were talking about with those traffic declines? They said themselves on the call that EBITDA pressure is expected to come from reduced top-line expectations. The company says it is actually attempting to adhere closely to its off-price principles, perhaps maybe that reason the consultant came in, as it has for 45 years. Again, Tuesday morning has existed since 1974 and has been going through periods of growth and periods of sort of divestment and retraction over the next 30 or 40 years. So this is really not uncommon for this retailer, but there is some concern about the need for some long-term balance here.
Now we continue our earnings season coverage with the office supply retail sector. As we mentioned in the intro, we're going to talk about Office Depot and Office Max. It used to be that we could rely on three different earnings calls in this space not too long ago, kind of like we do in the auto parts retail sector with the big three there. But after Office Depot and Office Max merged, and after Staples was taken private following another failed merger with Office Depot and Office Max, we have just one quarterly call here to give us insight into the sector. Now, in general, the sector has struggled mightily over the last 5 years, and there are a number of reasons for this. First, the retailers have been losing corporate contracts for office supplies and other products out to newer competitors, although that's not actually the case as much with Office Depot and Office Max. Their number of contracts for their business customers actually did increase during this last quarter. And second, it is a hole for the sector. This is definitely not an Amazon-proof space. Both Office Depot and Office Max and Staples cannot compete on price on many items with Amazon and other like businesses for those walk-in customers, for those retail customers, not necessarily those business contracts. Third, many general merchandise retailers have begun to encroach on the space. You're seeing a lot more coverage of office supplies by a lot of general merchandise retailers, people opting to go elsewhere for things like ink cartridge and back-to-school supplies. Fourth, companies who once ordered massive amounts of paper, toner, ink, and so forth have increasingly begun to go paperless and use cloud-based systems for collaboration, cutting into one of the sector's major traffic drivers. And we'll see even the contracts that Office Max and Office Depot have for things like paper and ink, those are kind of treating them poorly because of increased costs on paper, and we'll talk about that here in a second. And then fifth, but certainly not the last reason this sector is suffering, is that many technology providers have begun to use more of a direct-to-consumer approach for devices, leaving third-party retailers in the cold a bit. So you're no longer going to Office Depot or Office Max or Staples to buy a new computer for your business, rather going through those technology companies like Dell, for example, straight up. And Dell, for a very long time, has had that direct-to-consumer approach, but now we're kind of seeing other people hop on that bandwagon. So getting back to this earnings call, Zacks consensus analyst estimates had Office Depot's adjusted earnings per share coming in at 6 cents this year versus 8 cents last year. One other thing we should mention before Leighton delves into the call numbers, this call, which was for their first quarter of fiscal 2019, was actually delayed from early April. So they did release preliminary results at that time, which resulted in the stock losing about 20% of its market cap within a few days. So this is kind of the follow-up to some of those preliminary results that they released in April. And Leighton, I'll turn it over to you for some of the numbers.
In general, the call confirmed what we believe to be the path forward for Office Depot and Office Max. They are slowly becoming a service-oriented company versus just a retailer, and their overall sales were down 2% from the same quarter last year, coming in around $2.8 billion. Their BSD, or shall we say the Business Solutions Division, which handles many of their services, actually saw revenues increase 1%, which is really good for them. And their BSD is not entirely service-oriented, so when you break it down, their services revenue growth within BSD was actually up 13% year-over-year, which really tells you the bigger story of what we have going on here. They did mention that they are working on building sales on business-adjacent products within BSD, such as restroom and cleaning products, or even furniture for offices. And you see that part of this is the need to diversify. It's been driven by not only the turn from paper and ink, but also rising costs of paper on Office Depot's side that are really serving to compress margins for the business overall. And in an ordinary business model, input costs would be passed along to the customer, but because BSD is driven by contracts, they're really just served to compress margins, basically, because you have long-term contracts and long-term partners already established, and you've really been promising a certain price during that time frame. Meanwhile, same-store sales in their retail division were down 4%, and CompuCom revenue was also down 4%. Not a good thing. We actually talked about that coming together of those two companies not that long ago, it seems, but the same-store sales hit was despite services revenue being up 16% in their retail division. Although the services portion of the retail business is still fledgling and doesn't make up a large portion of the retail revenue as of yet, overall retail division sales were down 6%. That's the number we were honing in on here, a function of reduced comps and, yes, some store closure still for the company as they are looking to still look at leases and look at those stores that are underperforming relative to their larger store portfolio. 17 fewer stores in the first quarter of 2019 versus the first quarter of last year. As far as earnings are concerned, though, they did beat analyst estimates slightly, with adjusted net earnings per share coming in at 7 cents. Not too bad for all of those people that have been completely bearish on this particular retailer. Something that we are sometimes guilty of glossing over is the fact that the company is still profitable, and at the end of the day, Trent, they have a large percentage of market share in the United States still. And by the way, if you're a shareholder, they still issue a dividend, albeit a small one, because they don't make that much money. And for a company as a whole, they did cut their overall 2019 sales guidance from around $11.1 billion now to around $10.8 to $10.9 billion. A modest cutback, but still, you have a slight earnings beat with maybe lower than expected guidance, maybe mixed signals for those long-term shareholders. Speaking of shareholders, if you were listening to the call, those call insights, according to management, or more specifically, Jerry Smith, their CEO, also a mixed bag. As a whole, disappointed he was with their most recent acquisition of CompuCom and their results, CompuCom being that newer acquisition that we keep talking about. Their results from the first quarter sparked an internal self-assessment initiative as they were really concerned about the lack of progress that acquisition has made. Also worrisome is the fact that they call CompuCom their, and I quote, cornerstone of their services pivot, meaning that the business that they are relying most upon, most heavily upon, to diversify their business is performing below expectations. Not really a good thing or a good sign if you're a company executive. And on the retail side, however, the results were more or less in line with what management had expected early on. Their perpetually falling same-store sales is one of the reasons they ended up on our list of most struggling retailers for 2018. Sorry to say, but those executives probably don't listen to our podcast anyway. Some interesting numbers did come out on the retail side, such as ticket size being relatively similar to ticket size in the first quarter of 2018. Additionally, buy online, pickup in store sales did rise around 16% year over year. So that initiative is working out well. However, on the negative side of things, traffic was down significantly. Also, product sales in the retail division. So sales, not including services, were down a whopping 8% year over year. They noted, albeit in a Sears Holdings way, that their falling sales numbers are trending positive, with overall sales declining by around 6% in the retail sector this year versus 8% last year. Either way, numbers not looking that stellar for Office Depot. Usually product sales declines are accompanied by a reduction in income margin because of inventory bloat. That wasn't the case here with Office Depot and Office Max, with margin as a percentage of retail division sales going down slightly from around 5.7% to 5.6%. They credited their planning systems for anticipating the reduction in product sales for this, and that typically would help the balance sheet as well. Additionally, they reported lower lease costs with fewer stores open.
However, they do have some interesting initiatives on deck to attempt to leverage their brick and mortar footprint, or put more correctly, their existing supply chain infrastructure. So they do plan on using their brick and mortar footprint a little bit as they vacate certain areas of their stores and try to farm those out to different concepts. But more importantly for them, it's their supply chain infrastructure that they feel like they can get a hard benefit with. They're reaching out to a lot of third parties to leverage their supply chain and make use of their existing supply chain mechanisms, one of which, a very popular retailer in Alibaba. Now, with their retail initiatives, as I mentioned, some of their real estate, they're exploring store-within-a-store concepts, and in a few different locations throughout the U.S., they're trialing co-working space, which they credit for improving the in-store experience at those stores that have the co-working space there. They seem to be doing their best to use some of the resources that, while once required for the chain in terms of their retail square footprint, are really no longer needed. So you're seeing large amounts of their stores being taken up by, you know, things that honestly they no longer need as part of their overall business model. So they're trying to find ways to leverage that, because oftentimes they're locked into these long-term licenses in these large square foot buildings that they really can't flex out of or do anything other than sublet it going forward for the life of that lease. And when you think about their warehouse space, when you go back to their supply chain as an example, after the merger and continuing through today, many stores have closed, resulting in some extra headroom, so to speak, in terms of their warehouse capacities and their supply chain capacities. They still do have 1,359 stores in their retail division in the U.S., so they still do have a robust brick-and-mortar footprint, but it wasn't what it once was. And so enter Alibaba as one of the relationships that they hope to develop further in the months ahead. Office Depot feels as though this relationship with Alibaba might be a further revenue driver if they can use some of this available supply chain capacity, basically farming this out to Alibaba as a resource for them. Now, as a company as a whole, they've gone through pains as far as leveraging any synergies experienced from the merger, and that the synergies haven't necessarily shown themselves as yet on the balance sheet. As a result, the company is going through a massive reorganization, not only with human capital, but also with facilities and the like. The reorganization is expected to save Office Depot or Max around $40 million this year. They expect about a $100 million savings on a run rate going forward. Now, they were also fairly clear that there will be more store closures, although they didn't mention an anticipated amount, which is probably smart because, you know, anytime a store chain mentions closures on an earnings call, media runs with that in the headlines. So as a result, the Office Depot and Office Max earnings call kind of ran underneath the radar. They didn't get a lot of negative press from it. They referred to it more as potential closures of underperforming stores in this analysis going further. And interestingly enough, the analysts that were on the call didn't delve too far into the store closures other than to ask if they were already baked into the top line guidance. So as a final takeaway, we think analyst behavior on the call, speaking of those analysts, certainly tends to indicate where Office Depot and Office Max is headed as a company. There were basically no questions about the retail division during the Q&A, and the retail division was a much smaller part of the prepared statements than their other initiatives. Analysts wanted to focus mostly on CompuCom and the Business Services Division, or the BSD, which certainly dovetails where we feel like the company is pivoting too. And so even though they still have those over 1,300 retail stores, it seems like Office Depot and Office Max wants to think of themselves less as a retailer and more as a services provider going into the next decade. So because of that, we don't know exactly how many more earnings calls we'll be looking at, but we wanted to at least look at this one for them because it signifies an interesting moment in terms of the company's identity. And we can see that pivot becoming clearer day by day, and this earnings call certainly underscored that.
We switch gears. We go from office retail to grocery retail. An article this week in the Minneapolis Star Tribune included some interesting quotes from the CEO of Cub regarding a potential sale. First, let's talk a little bit about their backstory, an interesting backstory I made note, behind what was formerly known as Cub Foods. Now just Cub. Cub is a regional grocery chain with most of their holdings in the upper Midwest, mainly in Minnesota. So shout out to those listeners there in Minnesota. The Cub origin story is somewhat unique, but matches up with a number of other regional grocery chains throughout the U.S. that we have mentioned on the podcast. In fact, the first Cub store was started by Hooley's Supermarkets back in 1968 with the idea of it being a budget-conscious store similar to maybe a Food for Less. With those familiar with that concept, they have still quite a bit of locations out near where I live in Southern California now. As at Food for Less, customers bag their own groceries at Cub. Cub, by the way, initially was an acronym for Consumers United for Buying. So I don't know if that's creative or original, but that's what it was for. And Cub was originally run as a banner across multiple owners. The Hooley's portion of the chain, which was comprised of five stores, was then bought out by Super Value. Aside from this, Cub locations were also run at certain times by Winco Foods, Delays Group, and then Cerberus Capital Management, after Super Value, of course, acquired the new Albertsons. Eventually, Cub locations outside the company's wheelhouse began to close, and Super Value became the sole operator of Cub through attrition, basically. And fast forward to recently, when Super Value sold off the Save-A-Lot chain, the sell-off made Cub the largest retail banner under Super Value's ownership as the company began to transition to more of a distributor than both a distributor and a retailer. While for a short time, Super Value invested in updating the Cub banner, it was short-lived as Super Value was acquired by United Natural Foods in 2018. UNFI, in other words, has continued to invest somewhat in Cub, and in fact, Cub just opened a new store this month in Minneapolis. But they've made no secret about their desire to sell off Super Value's retail holdings. UNFI is actually first and foremost a distributor, by the way, and they have huge relationships with Whole Foods and other grocers around the United States, so it makes a little sense for them to bend over backwards to keep the retail side of the business going strong. By the way, their latest openings put Cub just at 79 stores overall.
So then we've talked about the background a little bit. That brings us to the most recent comments. In a discussion with John Evolt of the Minneapolis Star Tribune, Cub Foods CEO Mike Steigers openly talked about the prospect of the brand being sold away to another operator. The initial rumblings last year after the UNFI purchase of Super Value had Hy-Vee as a potential buyer. However, the CEO of Cub's longtime rival, Hy-Vee, or Randy Ettaker, dismissed notions that they would be in the running to purchase Cub. Honestly, from Hy-Vee's standpoint, they've got enough reinvestments going on within their store chain. And honestly, you wonder how many synergies could really be tapped into because a lot of Cub stores exist near other Hy-Vee stores. You'd figure a lot of the Cub stores would have to be closed down if Hy-Vee did purchase them. And the article also notes that Kroger may not be in a position to purchase Cub either. Although one thing that we noted from the article, it says that Kroger is struggling financially, which is not the case. Someone like Tuesday Morning is struggling financially. Kroger is still very much profitable. They're just reinvesting a lot of the funds into their digital initiatives. And this is something that we've pointed out in the past. Kroger back in 2016, after a few buyouts of local chains like Roundy's, for example, in the upper Midwest, they kind of made a pivot more towards an internal investment model, in part to build out their platforms like ClickList. So they're using their money or their cash on hand to kind of reinvest within the company rather than reach outside and grab additional store chains. Steiger said that as of right now, getting back to Cub, nothing is imminent. He reiterated the idea that UNFI is still providing support to the chain. And this is important because I think a lot of people thought that maybe UNFI might try to sweep Cub under the rug a little bit. Maybe that the chain would be ignored while they were still looking for a buyer. But to Layton's point, not only has Cub opened new stores recently, but they've completed a dozen remodels throughout the chain since last year. And the critical part, at least to Steiger's, is that the growth of the Cub brand not be stemmed. And I quote from his quote in the article, "There's no slowing down the growth of this brand as we look for the correct suitor in the future," end quote. So this seems to be a relatively rare situation in the retail world when a company on the shopping block is actually preened for potential buyers rather than ignored, kind of shuttled off towards the corner, as we've seen with other unwanted chains, Dollar Express, for example, in the long ago past. We've also seen it more recently as chains begin to attempt to sell off parts of their overall chain. Fred's certainly coming to mind in that regard, Shopko being another, as they were trying to sell off their pharmacies, kind of ignoring that part of the chain as they headed towards bankruptcy. But one thing that points to UNFI being in no particular hurry to sell off Cub is that their new Minneapolis store that they've just opened has a much different footprint than the other stores in the chain. So it's kind of an innovation of sorts when it comes to the Cub footprint. They're trumpeting the location as having an urban layout. They've got larger aisles to navigate in, a lot of ready-to-eat offerings, a juice bar, all the other grocery developments du jour that it seems like we talk about episode in, episode out when we talk about store openings. The store is actually serving as the ground floor of an apartment complex or a condo complex in the Minnehaha neighborhood there. Has a bit of a smaller square footage also than most of the other Cub stores in the chain. So here we're seeing UNFI willing to work with Cub, thinking outside the box, and really working to make the chain attractive to potential buyers. So if that buyer comes tomorrow, then great. If not, they're working to set up Cub to where they're not going to be a liability on the company overall going forward. Now, when asked about his approach to running a company that might have a new owner at any time, Steiger's did say that they're basically focused on running and building Cub right now. If something happens with the sale, great. They'll deal with it at that point. If not, they're focused on running Cub as a successful and profitable part of UNFI. And it's rumored that part of the potential issue with selling Cub is that UNFI wants to sell Cub as one unit rather than being willing to split it off to different buyers. It might make it more attractive to, say, a buyer like Hy-Vee if they could just pick and choose which stores they acquire. But the key here and the biggest takeaway from the article as a whole is that Steiger said if UNFI did not find a buyer, they're not in a position to decide to just close the stores altogether. His exact words were that closure, and I quote, "is not on anyone's radar screen whatsoever," end quote. And although you might expect a CEO of a subsidiary on the selling block to say no different, we've seen companies be very upfront about the potential for closure in the past. One notable recent example that comes to mind is when Tillman Fertitta came out after Landry's bought Ignite Brands, Ignite, of course, owning Joe's Crab Shack and Brickhouse Tavern and Tap, saying that, hey, they bought it because of Joe's Crab Shack, basically going to attempt to sell Brickhouse Tavern and Tap immediately as a subsidiary. If that chain didn't sell, it would basically be shuttered. So that is one example of, you know, someone being very upfront about the chain's goals going forward if something can't sell. Now, the reason for Cub, at least, this has been somewhat of a concern, is that two top executives recently left Cub, Ann Dement and Chad Ferguson. This sparked a lot of rumors in the grocery industry that there may be a change of foot regarding the subsidiary. And what's interesting here, and I think this is perhaps an interesting part about the article as being a powerful PR piece for Cub more than anything, is that these rumors of a potential closure are especially strong among the customer base. In fact, the top two Google questions regarding Cub as of this week are, is Cub Foods going out of business, and are Cub Food stores closing? So I think here you're looking at a CEO that's trying to get on top, trying to get in front of the message, saying to his customer base and also his employees, hey, we're not looking at closing anytime soon. If UNFI can't find a buyer, it's not a problem. They're committed to running Cub Foods long term, but they would prefer to sell off to another grocery operator for whom Cub Foods would be more in their wheelhouse. And I think that's a strong statement for a CEO to make. And it's also worthy of talking about on a podcast such as this one, when it seems like week in, week out, we're talking about consolidation or deconsolidation in certain industries, grocery, of course, being one of them. Here you have an operator committed to running a store chain long term, even if they'd rather that store chain not be in their portfolio. A unique situation indeed.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
We've reached the final segment of the Retail Focus podcast, where each Leighton and I take a look ahead at one story we're keeping an eye on for the next week, month, or year, and we begin with Leighton.
My story is going to be relatively little in length. However, it was a little bit hard to find a story this week because there's so much out there in terms of retail news. It was not a totally light week in terms of retail news out there. I was trying to decide between Walmart trying to open 100 in-store veterinary clinics or Party City, but Party City won the battle. So I will dive into my looking ahead story, which has to do with the media headlines pointing to the closure of 45 stores, basically trying to argue that that is, again, the revisiting of a retail apocalypse. However, if you dig a little bit deeper into their first quarter, they didn't actually perform that bad. And that news that the CEO was giving of the 45 closures of its 870 store base, well, guess what? They're opening 200 additional stores over the next few years. And I think that that should actually be the headline if you were to cover retail in an accurate way. So the 45 stores has to do with stores that were underperforming or too close to other locations, and they felt like perhaps they were being cannibalized, and they're going to use that money, and I quote, they're going to capture savings of some of those underperforming stores to serve underserved markets. And so they didn't specify exactly where they're going, but this is really good news, and we're fans of Party City. While we only talk about them once or twice a year, this is a retailer that does have some staying power. You think of the Amazon-proof retailers out there, Party City is definitely one of those. They're able to keep their price points low because of their vertical integration. They have manufacturing facilities in Latin America. They've been doing very well at organizing their supply chain based off of that strategy. And so I think between increasing those margins, or at least maintaining strong margins, and then maintaining foot traffic, which they have been able to do, believe it or not, over the past couple of years, they've really proven themselves as a niche retailer that has long-term potential for sustainability. And if you look at Party City's first quarter, net sales increased about 1%, which isn't that great, but comparable store sales actually fell. The reason being, both of those numbers would be actually much, much better. But there was something that we thought was interesting before we ended up recording this podcast. We were talking about the helium shortage, which ended up hurting not only Party City, but any balloon maker out there that wants to sell balloons in the retail environment. There was a massive shortage in helium. So those same store sales falling, Trent, they would have actually gained 0.7% if not for helium. So shout out to helium out there. Probably needs to get its act together for Party City heading in to the second quarter. But I'm most looking ahead to what stores they open and what kind of store they are looking at. This is going to be a new concept, something they've been talking about for some time, between 7,000 and 10,000 square feet. I would assume that some of those 200 additional stores, Trent, are conventional in nature, so maybe some are over 10,000 square feet in size. I would like to see Party City actually come down a little bit in size, and therefore they can open up opportunities and maybe strike some deals in some maybe borderline problematic shopping centers that are anchored by, let's say, a Walmart or a nearby Target.
And what's interesting about that helium shortage is we actually saw an article from the New York Post, and granted, the New York Post isn't exactly a journalistic bastion or anything like that, claiming basically that the stores that they closed closed because of the helium shortage and that the chain could be in dire straits and all of that. But actually on the earnings call, they talked about the store chain actually inking a deal to continue helium supplies for the rest of the chain for the next couple of years. So again, the store closures, not as a result of the helium shortage. If you read that, that's incorrect. It's basically taking two separate things that they addressed on the call and mashing them together. However, if you listen to our podcast talking about Party City's last earnings call, it was a little bit of a negative surprise. They did address closing some underperforming stores there. So this is something that has been kind of in the works for Party City for a while. Helium isn't the reason they're closing the stores, but it is, as Leighton mentioned, the reason that their same-store sales didn't come in as well as what they had expected. So Leighton took Party City. I'm going to go back to Walmart and talk about them not only launching an online pet pharmacy. That's not so much what I'm looking at here. I'm looking at the veterinary clinics. The company said this last week it plans to grow the number of veterinary clinics in its stores to over 100. And the reason I find this interesting, you know, you look, obviously it makes sense to do the online pet pharmacy thing. People are spending a lot on pets. We don't want to beat a dead horse about it. No pun intended, although that would be a little bit of a gruesome pun here. But in this case, no surprise that people are spending more on pets. But my question is, how are they planning, if they do grow this concept out larger, how are they planning on balancing the veterinary clinics with the rest of their retail presence? Because the idea is, hey, if you can bring people to stores, bring people to the stores for the veterinary clinics, you might be able to keep them around and keep them shopping. Well, anyone who's ever been in the grocery industry knows that service animals, hey, A-OK in stores. But you're opening yourself up to, you know, if you go to a PetSmart, go to a Petco, obviously people have their pets in there because they've just picked them up from the veterinary clinic and they're going around doing their shopping. That's something that's not really possible under a lot of food laws. And when you look at Walmart, of course, one of the biggest things that they sell is groceries. So how are these Walmarts going to balance the need to have people bring their pets to these stores, to these veterinary clinics, and yet shop maybe afterwards, after they've picked up the pet from the veterinary clinic, or after they've sat with the pet in the veterinary clinic? And so that's kind of the interesting thing that I'm looking at. How is Walmart going to balance this? It's already, you know, if you go to a grocery store, if you go to someone like a Walmart, they're already pretty quick to notice any non-service animal that's in the store. So that's what I want to look at. And then further, if they do decide to let, you know, animals in the store that maybe aren't service animals, how do other people react to that? So if Walmart can find a way around regulations, how do other people react to that? Because not everyone is a dog person, not everyone is a cat person, not everyone is a pet person. So you risk maybe alienating some of your customer base, which is something that PetSmart and Petco don't have to worry about. So that'll do it for us here on the Retail Focus Podcast. For Leighton, I'm Trent, saying so long until next week. A reminder, check us out and find us on Twitter and Instagram at Retail Podcast, and we'll be back with you soon.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.